When I was a kid, my favorite game to play with my sister on the PlayStation 1 was Croc 2.
Oh, I remember that game.
Hi everyone. Welcome to Bite Marks, a podcast for gamers, by gamers, about politics. My name is Callum and I'm joined here today. Oh, pronouns he, him. And I'm joined here today with my co-host, Emilio.
Hey, everybody. I'm Emilio. Pronouns he, him. Callum.
Today's kind of a lazy Tuesday sort of podcast, huh?
Callum, it's Wednesday.
It is what?
It's Wednesday.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I guess that fits into with today's theme because you're nostalgic for yesterday.
For Tuesday, my least favorite day of the week.
Yeah, Tuesday is a tough one.
Tuesday is nothing. Tuesday is there to buffer when to make Wednesday important.
If you think about it, Tuesday is just an extended Monday.
Tuesday is like the grade 9 of the days of the week, because nothing fucking happens in grade 9. In grade 10, you pick your subjects, and in grade 8, you start high school, but grade 9 is nothing.
Yeah, that's very relevant for what we're going to be talking about today.
It's a theory I came up with a long time ago, if you can believe it.
Yeah, I can, actually. So today's topic was, well, actually, you know, it is kind of relevant because of the Steam sale, I ended up buying a bunch of really old games to play because none of the new games on my wish list were out yet because, it, you know, making new games is tricky. And today we're going to be talking about a topic that I think shows up often in discussions about video games, and that is nostalgia. So why don't you introduce the topic for our viewers at home?
Amelia, I don't know if you're big into, like, watching or reading about gaming? It doesn't really seem like your thing.
Yeah, I mean, I only have, like, 4 gaming history, like, news podcasts, that YouTube channels that I listen to, so it's not really, you know, my thing, per se.
Only 4, look at this guy. But anyway, if you've spent any time in the gaming community, you have heard people use the word nostalgia.
Yes.
To describe a series or like a specific game, and usually it's a word that means good, but with like an undercurrent of insult.
Yeah,
because nostalgia almost feels like a trick.
Yeah, I think so I did a lot of research for this episode. I read about like a bunch of different scientific papers, so I think I would.
I spent 20 minutes in a Word document.
So I think I'd like to add a little bit of like what other people, what academics sort of think about nostalgia. There was an academic by the name of Svetlana Boyum, and in their seminal work, "The Future of Nostalgia," they came up with this idea that there are actually 2 types of nostalgia. When it comes to media, there is restorative and reflective nostalgia.
Are you kidding me? Are you actually kidding me?
No.
Okay, no, folks at home, when I pitched this idea to Emilio, I came up with 2 types of nostalgia called passive and aggressive. And now he's delivering me this shit. And where's my goddamn, like, scientific award?
Svetlana Boyum is apparently a very big deal in the whole, like, cultural literature studies. So, maybe Callum was...
Yeah, we should find him. We should get him on.
Yeah, maybe.
If he's not dead.
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know.
So restorative and reflective nostalgia is basically, quote-unquote, good and bad nostalgia. Now, I will note that other people seem to take issue with Boyum's characterization because basically nostalgia is a human thing, right? Everyone is nostalgic about about potentially anything. In fact, we have records going back thousands of years about people like being nostalgic for earlier times, you know, like imagine being a ancient Mesopotamian and being like, yeah man, everything kind of sucks nowadays, I really really wish we could go back to like hunter-gathering.
I mean, people are like that now.
Yeah, Anthems are...
I've seen, like, 8 memes about returning to hunting and gathering today.
Yeah, I don't think people realize just how difficult hunting and gathering actually was.
No.
But
we have big boxes in our house that keeps our food cold and fresh, and if you take mine away from me, I will fight. That's how Mad Max starts, yeah. Is me.
Losing your fridge.
Yeah, me losing my fridge and going feral.
Yeah, so a Boehm characterizes restorative nostalgia as, like, reactionary, i.e. the bad kind of nostalgia. Basically, the idea about restorative nostalgia is you're trying to build a monument to the past, right? So you're trying to create, evoke ideas about a past that never existed. You're, like, building a literally, it's like building a monument to the past. Whereas reflective nostalgia is, like, trying to grapple with what the past means, right? So to bring it home with the sort of like video game examples, we see plenty of examples of both restorative and also reflective nostalgia in video games, right? Like, take for example, Duke Nukem Forever. Duke Nukem Forever is not a game.
Wait, let that sit for a
moment. Viewers at home, oof, who are old enough to remember
13 years.
Yeah, 13 years, right? And what kind of game is Duke Nukem Forever? It is essentially the kind of game that would only exist to glorify a washed-up action hero, you know? It's not a game that is interested in deconstructing what Duke Nukem was, his influence on masculinity, or anything like that. It's purely trying to present a monument to what Duke Nukem was.
As this is essentially a zero-punctuation fan cast at this point, I do want to mention that his video on Duke Nukem Forever highlights a lot of, like, great points about it. It's basically, as he says, they tried to build a house next to a boat on a river.
Yeah, yeah.
And the boat kept going past them, obviously, because that's how it worked. And if you, like, cut Duke Nukem Forever in half, you can basically see the last 13 years of gaming.
Yeah, and it's not a... So it's restorative in the sense that, like, it's not attempting to be critical about what Duke Nukem was. If I remember that episode correctly, Yahtzee was actually approached to write for Duke Nukem, and he was trying to do it reflectively, i.e. he would try to deconstruct Duke Nukem as a character and almost kind of make a Duke Nukem game about making fun of Duke Nukem. An example of reflective nostalgia, to sort of round out the metaphor, is that... it would be something like, I think possibly like maybe some of the later Doom games, like Doom Eternal and Doom 2016, are maybe a little bit more reflective nostalgia. They are essentially homages to the original Doom formula, but they are very different to the original Doom. They do try to fix problems that existed with the formula that in Doom.
I think.
Yes.
You're overlooking the most obvious example.
Yes.
Breath of the Wild.
Of course, right.
it took the tired Zelda formula of using items to explore and elevated it.
Yeah, it's important to differentiate, I think, and we kind of immediately answered our own question by, like, you know, coming up with this idea of, like, good and bad nostalgia. But I don't necessarily think the line is so clear with video games. One thing that came out in the research is that video games are a unique problem for cultural studies. In a couple of ways. One of the problems with them is that, like, video games are simultaneously almost like 60 years old now at this point in time, but they're also like an incredibly young medium that has basically no good historical preservation, right? Like, nostalgia is difficult. Well, nostalgia is very easy with movies because, you know, movies, generally speaking, are quite well preserved. We can even watch, you know, some of the very first films ever on something like YouTube, you know? Whereas with games, it's much harder to preserve them, and the games industry does a terrible job of remembering to preserve anything. And so...
No backwards compatibility on any modern console.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like we're in this weird situation where the nostalgia that is being created in the gaming industry is driven not by the industry itself, although I'll explain that, but it's actually in some cases like driven by... people's perception of their own play experiences, because as time goes on, we just will not have access to that earlier period in history. Not many games are actually being ported over, you know, to new hardware or, you know, new consoles, and it's kind of sad because I feel like
it's a damn shame. We're losing some real masterpieces.
Yeah, but also, I think we're also just losing examples of cultural history, right? Like, one of the problems that I think we have as a species is that we tend to only remember the good stuff. You know, we tend to, in terms of the works that survive, we only tend to remember the good stuff. And I think that clouds our perception of the past. I think a lot of people, for example, I have a personal experience where I was playing a retro game, and I have really fond memories of playing it. But playing it nowadays is not a good experience. and this was...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This,
no, go ahead.
Sorry. When I was a kid, my favorite game to play with my sister on the PlayStation 1 was Croc 2.
Oh, I remember that game.
What a terrifyingly abysmal game. But we loved it. And it became like a big thing for us. Ice Climbers as well. I used to watch my sisters play Ice Climbers together. And Ice Climbers looks so fucking boring. Now it looks so terrible. Like, I don't know what the point of it is, but it was essentially the first foray into gaming I ever had.
Yeah, you know, it's sort of interesting because I do want to expand a little bit more about like the study of nostalgia, because I think it is important to sort of ground our axioms. And I spent a lot of time reading those papers, so I want to put some of that to use. So in the scholarship, they also differentiate not only between ways in which you engage with nostalgia, either reflexively or restoratively, but also types of nostalgia. So video games are kind of unique because previously we used to only have mediated nostalgia and media nostalgia. So mediated nostalgia is where you engage with something and it reminds you of something else. So for example, let's say you're playing Yakuza 0 and you go into a nightclub and you think, wow, this nightclub actually reminds me of the time I went to a nightclub in Japan. That is an example of mediated
wild example.
Nostalgia.
What a wild fucking example. You just, instead of like, oh, that time you're playing GTA 4 and you buy an outfit that looks exactly like one you own.
Well, it's...
Or something. Like, no, the time you were like, I went to a nightclub in Japan and man, Yakuza 0 rarely pulls me back to those halcyon days.
Well, I chose Yakuza 0 because it is a simulation game, right? The thing that is brought up about Yakuza is that it's designed to be a simulation in a sense of like... Yakuza life in Japan, you know? And I think that is like an important point to differentiate. But the other type of nostalgia is media nostalgia, i.e. you remember, like with your example with Croc 2, you remember playing the thing. So if you play Croc 2 again, not that you would ever have any reason to, you will remember, you know, that experience. However, video games kind of give us a blend of these types of nostalgia, right? Like, what has happened with video games, because they are a thing that you experience, but also a thing that exists as, like, a media property, we kind of get now a blending of these types of nostalgia, where you can be nostalgic for a play experience that you can be reminded of by something else, you know?
Oh, yeah, definitely. There's this weird phenomenon that happens every time I play Disco Elysium, because I got that game during a point in my life where things weren't going great. So every time I play it, I get like anxious, weirdly. And it's kind of blended into my experience of the game that I also remember enjoying. So now it's like this weird good anxiety.
Yeah, yeah, that's a great example of what I mean, right? A video game is a unique piece of medium because you can blend experiences of playing, engaging with the medium, but also experiences from outside with the medium, you know? Like, for example, one of my favorite Ratchet & Clank games is Ratchet & Clank Deadlocked. And most of the...
That's Ratchet & Clank Gladiator for the American?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's the one where Ratchet gets kidnapped and forced to participate in, like, a TV show deathmatch type thing.
In American Gladiator.
Yeah.
But with guns.
But with guns, yeah. So, the thing, I have lots of memories of playing that game with other people. And it doesn't... But even though... Even when I'm like if I'm watching like a cutscene or something like that, I can still remember playing the game. You know, I can still remember those playing experiences. And when I see a PlayStation 2, I tend to think of Ratchet and and Clank Deadlock, because I played it on a PlayStation 2. So there is this, you know, unique issue with nostalgia with video games, because on the one hand, it gives us a blended form, but there is one other problem. Obviously, we've spent a lot of time talking about our personal nostalgia, right? Feelings that we have that are personal, and this relates to something that I talked about earlier. Callum, video games has a problem with cultural nostalgia, right?
Yeah.
So we don't have a very strong culture of preservation in video games, right? Oftentimes, most games...
Oh. Yeah, I mean, no, yeah, we did just agree on that. I will say when it comes to nostalgia, there's a different story.
Yeah, so one thing that's very interesting when you look at video games is that even though we don't have, like, strong cultures of preservation, and, like, the average gamer now is, like, 30, you know, nostalgia pervades gaming everywhere. I think that's, like...
It's the only reason they get to keep making Sonic games.
Yeah, that, and I presume that, like, there's, like, a demon compact that Sega signed.
You know the owl from the, from, like, the 3D Zelda games?
Yeah.
That's the demon that Nintendo contracted with, so they have to keep remaking Mario and Zelda forever.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Shigeru Miyamoto is, like, he did a blood ritual in the basement of Nintendo, and, yeah, that's just why we have more Zelda games. Sorry, guys.
Sugoi.
Yeah.
I will say, though, an interesting, like, because you say cultural nostalgia, and obviously the first thing that jumps to everyone's mind is Nintendo properties that keep being remade, and, you know, Sonic and stuff like that.
Japan, really.
Here's a new weird one.
Mm-hmm.
Skyrim.
Oh, yeah.
Skyrim came out 11 years ago. No. Yeah, technically, just a bit after 11 years ago, like a little bit more. And it's been re-released, Emilio. Guess how many times?
6 or 7 times, I'm guessing.
You got it on the head. It's 7 times over the last 11 years. It surpassed Resident Evil 4, I think.
With the number of re-releases.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
And it does have this almost historical revisionism like quality to it, because it's really removed. I forgot that Bethesda created Fallout 76.
You did?
I've totally forgotten that Bethesda made Fallout in general.
Wow.
They will always be to me the company games that re-releases Skyrim, yeah.
You know, I kind of want to ask your opinion about that, because I think, so even if we keep in mind reflexive and restorative nostalgia, right? Like, it is possible for good nostalgia and bad nostalgia to, like, intermingle, and for some things to, like, be a bit blended. Like, for example, you know, our personal nostalgia, we can be both reflective or restorative. You know, I have fond memories of a video game that if anyone criticizes that game, I will fight them on it, you know? Even if that game is terrible, right? It's not good of me to do, but, you know, I don't necessarily think it's, like, socially harmful. But when we're talking about industry norms, when we're talking about development standards, and like, for example, re-releasing the same game 7 times in a row, you know, and not making Elder Scrolls 6, I feel like there are very negative problems that have pervaded gaming culture, in part because of nostalgia, right?
But not only that, it's tainted the impact of the community.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest and most incredible things about Skyrim was its modding community. They were so driven, they made so many big things, and they kept the game alive for years.
Well, that was Bethesda's MO, right? Release a game, and for some reason the modders will go absolutely insane and, like, fix it, even if it's broken.
Yeah, because Bethesda doesn't make games. Bethesda makes a pile of game, and then throws it at you, and it's your job to fix it.
They make a Lego set of games, and you have to actually put it together.
It's like people are still making mods for Skyrim.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've only gotten bigger. They're basically creating new games.
I think the
using the Skyrim menu.
Yeah, I think the Sky Oblivion mod trailer actually got a release on IGN. That's how big it was.
Yeah, I saw that and I thought, like, fuck me, they will do anything to not release Elder Scrolls 6, because I thought it was, like, from Bethesda.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Because, like, they're on IGN, you know, like, official IGN, like, it's actual games network, and here they are releasing a mod trailer for remaking another Bethesda game in another Bethesda. Oh my goodness. Why do you think that is? Like, I mean, obviously we can speculate, but why do you think nostalgia has pervaded the games industry to such an extent, you know?
Well, because it's easy. I mean, look, it's very easy to cherry pick the moments in your life that felt good, without the context surrounding it. I was not a generally happy kid, but there were specific moments in my childhood where I was very happy, and I can pick those out and be nostalgic for whatever I was doing in that moment. Mm-hmm. But, like, for instance, one of the happiest times during my childhood was when I was watching Scott Pilgrim vs. the World for the first time. But that's not because I really, really love that movie. It's a good movie, but it's because of the situation around that movie. Mm-hmm. It's because I was having a bad day and my sister went and picked up a couple movies for us to watch together.
Yeah, we used to have to go to a place to get movies.
Yeah, we went to a Blockbuster. But yeah, that's what made the memory good, is that interaction with me and my sister. And now that movie is like riding off of that good memory for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Which, again, I don't mind. It's not a bad movie or anything. It's just like you cherry pick a moment and then you get cherry juice all over everything in that moment.
Yeah, I think there is an obsession, possibly to people's detriments, with trying to pretend that they're like mega always objective, you know? Like, humans are very messy. And our lives are very messy, and I think invariably people are, and you know, we have imperfect memories and stuff like that, and I think what's going to happen if you just live as a human being, you're going to pick up all sorts of things that form a little bundle of contradictions, you know, in your life. Mm. And you just have to deal with it. And I feel like for some people, pretending that, like, every time, like, this happened with, you know, with the Hogwarts Legacy thing recently, a lot of people come out and pretend that they never liked Harry Potter, when, no, you did like Harry Potter. It's okay to not like a thing now, you know, because your opinion has changed. You don't have to always have been good. You know, you can be a person who learns and evolves and changes their opinion. You don't, you know, like, it's weird, right? Because I think people have that reflexive need, because I think partially it is kind of nostalgia, because it's like a defense mechanism, you know, where it's like you don't want to associate those good feelings that you have with the media with now, like, say, a bad feeling that you have. But, like, that's just not how it's going to work, you know? Right now, there's a kid.
That's also a tougher situation. Before you carry on, there's also a tough situation with that, because we do live in a very, like, socially driven world.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't like the right things, you will get ostracized.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I feel like that's a very, like, bad social trend to normalize, but to continue.
Yeah, it's almost like we're in a dystopia.
The most boring dystopia, you know.
It sucks. Where's our cyberpunk? Like, I want like 8 eyes and 3 arms. Why the hell do I have to be in the dystopia where people cancel each other on Twitter and it doesn't matter?
Because Elon Musk owns Twitter, Callum. That's what happened. The rich guy in the dystopia novel didn't, like, I don't know, invent like replicants or whatever. He just bought Twitter.
Yeah. I mean, Louis C.K. got canceled on Twitter for committing like actual genuine crimes, and he sold out an arena show later.
Yeah.
It
absolutely doesn't. But to finish my rant, it's like there's a kid right now who is growing up, and their entire life they watched Rick and Morty like religiously. And then, yeah, I know, right?
That's a hard life.
They're a kid, right? So they don't know, like, you know, stuff. And then they're going to find out what Justin Roiland did. And, you know, they're going to have the experience that all of us have, which is, how do I reconcile my own feelings and my own beliefs with the idea that a person that I respected or liked made something good, but that person is also bad. I do want to veer this back a little bit to games. I think one issue that we have with nostalgia, which...
Well, I mean, if you want an example like this from games, mm-hmm. it's like Ubisoft. One of my favorite series growing up was Assassin's Creed.
I was just about to break up Assassin's Creed.
One of my favorite series growing up was Assassin's Creed, and I eventually kind of dropped it after a while because I saw what they were doing with it. Mm-hmm. But if I had kept playing it and been so invested in it and loved every new change and whatever, and then the news came out about all of the like sexual abuse that goes on at Ubisoft, mm-hmm. I would have had to reconcile, do I still love this thing that's made by hundreds of people? Mm-hmm. Or do I,
you know, do give it up,
completely drop it?
Yeah, no, of course. It's a complicated thing. Ubisoft is a very interesting example because they show up often, actually, in these studies. In a lot of the papers that I was reading, Ubisoft games showed up like a third of the time. Oof, so I don't.
That's not a good sign.
No, it's not.
We don't do studies on healthy people.
Yeah, no. Just as a brief tangent, like what I was reading, all the sources will be linked in the description, folks. One of our videos in a long time, which will have lots of sources. We're bread tubers when the video has sources, and we're podcasters when it doesn't. they were talking about like how Ubisoft creates false nostalgia, right? So. In Assassin's Creed, I think it's Unity, which is the one that is in France. Unity, right?
Unity.
Right. So yeah. One of the things that was touted about Unity is, of course, that they provide a very realistic depiction of, like, 19th century France.
Well, you know,
well,
ancient secret orders, yeah, well, notwithstanding.
It's when people talk about, like, the architecture and stuff like that, right? Like, people were doing like studies of nostalgia using Ubisoft games, and they found some very interesting things. Like, for starters, Ubisoft is actually not presenting France as it is. They are pandering to a cultural memory, right? The Cathedral of Notre Dame should not look like what it does. The famous arches that are actually distinctive of that cathedral were only added after the game takes place. So they deliberately pandered to essentially an image of a cultural idea of what Notre Dame was supposed to be, you know? There was like another mention in another study about like how people from the Middle East find the first Assassin's Creed game to be very nostalgic, as like a cultural nostalgia for a time when like the Middle East wasn't plagued by war and strife and things like that. Although I guess in the Crusade,
you mean that game that was happening during the Crusade?
Well, at a time when
plagued the Middle East with war and strife.
Well, at a time when the Middle East was much more of a power in the world than a victim, you know. Like
I guess so.
It is kind of interesting because games can be about nostalgia, but also not about nostalgia. You know, like
I'm surprised they aren't more mad about it that a guy named Altair has an American accent.
Well, he is. I guess
he's not American.
Well, Desmond is American.
America doesn't exist.
Yeah, well, America.
Yeah, but then why do all of Desmond's other ancestors get their appropriate accents?
Look, Ubisoft at the time are also the company that thought that people wouldn't want to play as a woman, and therefore they gatekept female assassins out of their games for years and years and years.
And then released it on a handheld.
And you released it on a handheld, so
that was dying.
Yeah, they're not a company that is, making a lot of good decisions. But I think it's interesting because I would argue that like when games companies are like the most hit game of like this year, I feel like there are going to be lots of remakes coming out this year. There's the remake of Resident Evil 4, which a lot of people have debated about whether or not we even needed a remake. And then there's
we don't.
I don't think so as well. I feel like the remake is not going to capture the campiness of that game.
I feel like all of the Resident Evil like remakes that they've started doing has been an enormous cash grab that we've all fallen for. And it's justified with, like, the first three, because you could maybe not play those ones still. Like, they're too old for you to keep playing.
Who has a GameCube?
But it's not justified for Resident Evil 4. I can play that now on my Switch.
Would it be okay? So, like, I am totally in agreement, right? I don't know necessarily if Dead Space needed a remake, because I could I feel like the first Dead Space is really good, as it was, you know? But, like, we have a problem, I think, with video games, where we simultaneously keep wanting to bring up past things, but we also don't really want to do any make any effort to, like, preserve them. Nowadays, a lot of games are running on, like, live services, and when those servers shut down. They're gone. They're dead, you know?
Yeah.
You're never going to be...
That's an unsustainable model.
Of course, it's completely unsustainable. You know, I feel like nowadays... We're going to have like a black hole in gaming history in like 10 years time, or maybe even 5 years, when so many of the games that people grew up playing, just you're not going to be able to play it anymore because the servers for that game shut down, and that's the only way that you could have played the game.
Isn't that a damn shame? Isn't that a damn shame, y'all, that some of your favorite games right now you'll never be allowed to play again? Because not enough people spend money on it.
Yeah. Like, there are kids right now who their favorite game is Fortnite. And when they're grown up, they're probably not going to be able to play Fortnite.
It'll be Five Nights.
Yeah, Five Nights. yeah, like, when they cross over with FNAF.
Oh, God.
No. Okay, wait.
The fucking... The game theories universe.
Yeah, actually, that does bring up, like, a good point. Like, would you consider what Fortnite does to bring in, like, loads of franchises and stuff like that? Is that attempting to use nostalgia to sell something, or is that something else?
I want to say it's nostalgia. Because, like, Dragon Ball Z characters,
mm-hmm.
there's been a new series of Dragon Ball Z lately. It's called Dragon Ball Super. Mm-hmm. I don't know how... It must have been popular with kids. Dragon Ball Z is always been popular with kids, but I don't know if it's like necessarily why they brought it into Fortnite's player base, but it even if they didn't, like, they are banking on some nostalgia from that.
Yeah.
I also want to say it's just pure insanity, because why did they have like a Martin Luther King Memorial Museum?
Yeah, okay, look.
That you could do fun gun violence.
If you wanted proof that we're living in a dystopia, just log into the Fortnite Fortnite lobby to visit the MLK Memorial Museum. Oh, God.
And watch Vegeta really have a staring contest with Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yeah, I don't know. So, like, on the one hand, I'm tempted to say that it is nostalgia, because I remember those properties. Like, if Master Chief gets brought into... Fortnite. I remember playing Halo as a kid. You know, that's like a thing. But on the other hand, Fortnite's primary demographic are young people. And I feel like a lot of them, what we're actually looking at here is like a transitive form of nostalgia, where gamers have
Don't steal from my notes.
This was also brought up in the, this was also brought up in the, some of the papers. It's like,
Is this the same guy?
No.
I swear to God, if it's that guy you told me about earlier, but I'm being stolen from by two different psychology papers.
Svetlam Boyum. Boyum? I don't know. No, it's like we have a nostalgia which, by proxy, right? Where gamers generally, like, if you've never played Mario, you know who Mario is, right? Like
it's like cultural osmosis.
Cultural osmosis, where it's like there is, even though we're not good at preserving gaming history, and most people will never ever play most of the old games, we still have an idea of what gaming culture looks like. We have like a rough timeline of what gaming history is.
That's so wild. We essentially, as like a gaming community, have an oral tradition rather than a written tradition.
Yeah, that is interesting, because like, if you think about a written tradition of history, people will write histories about the past. People will read those and then write more and stuff like that. And gradually, so...
And, I mean, we have that. We have, like, gaming articles and stuff like that. But, like... And videos and things. But that's the other thing, is we have videos on this.
Hmm.
And that fits into an oral tradition.
Yeah, because, you know, there are loads of channels that make a living on YouTube by just being... 7-hour gaming retrospectives.
I mean, fuck me. It's been like a million years, and you still can't stop us from being those weird little half-ape things dancing around a fire telling each other stories, can you?
No, I don't think the fundamental, like, I don't think the fundamental hardware of humanity has changed. I think the software needs some updating, but I don't think the hardware has changed at all, you know? It is kind of interesting, right? Because when gamers talk about our collective history, I feel like there is a sense, and maybe you can corroborate this, it's like there is a sense that like gaming used to be better. I feel like a core component of nostalgia is this idea that like I'm going back to a time when things used to be better. And obviously, if you're a person, if you're talking about personally for you, that's different. But when we talk about like gaming cultural nostalgia, I feel like lots of gamers are like, oh yeah, games used to be better.
Yeah.
No, and definitely. is that not maybe just like a little bit true to some extent?
No. Okay. I don't think so.
Okay, wait, let me maybe not better, but maybe games used to be less commodified.
I will say this, that was actually a point that I'm going to bring up. I think the reason that people think games used to be better is that, one, games used to be cheaper, but that you're not factoring in like inflation. Mm-hmm. And stuff like that, you know, games probably didn't used to be cheaper. It's just gotten more expensive because inflation happened. But also, I think games used to be more varied.
Mm.
And that has good and bad qualities.
Yeah.
As a player, that's great because it means that you get to try something and it's weird. I played Magicka with Miles on stream, not to date this video. I won't say when. But we made a point of saying, like, this was made in 2011, and games just aren't like this anymore.
Yeah, I think I totally agree with you. I think the instinctual idea that, oh, things were always better in the past, that's an example of restorative nostalgia. That's bad, right? Because I think, yes, it blinds you to the fault. It's not like every game back in the day was good, you know?
Oh, yeah. And that's the problem, is, like, variety is great for the consumer. It's not great for the producer.
Yeah.
How many gaming studios just went belly up? Yeah,
because they took a risk on something and it didn't work.
Yeah, that's probably why so many of the like major gaming studios now keep re-releasing easily bankable titles.
Because they can't afford... Yeah, it's this weird kind of phenomena that has been produced by capitalism where games are only getting more expensive to produce, but they're also simultaneously requiring more investment to make, and also the return expectation is also going higher. So we have to make a more expensive game that has to earn more money. You know, like famously, Dead Space as a series died because even though the games were selling well for their target market, they weren't selling well enough to keep making them, despite the fact that they were never, you know, unpopular games. Loads of people love them, right? It's just that the sales expectation for Dead Space, a horror game, mind you, which always has a smaller audience than, say, other games, was never going to exceed, you know, something like a Call of Duty.
Well, that ultimately is why live service games will fail. Because, and just to dissuade any plagiarism arguments, I did see the extra punctuation about this, and I agree. I have a lot of nostalgia for that episode. So I agree with the point that Yati makes of, like, there can't be infinite money.
No, there can't be.
That can't work in capitalism, because there needs to be infinite growth to accompany it. And you can't expect a player to put, like, 8 hours of their free time into a game twice in one day. Mm-hmm. Or you can't expect your audience to double every time, like, a new day happens. Because mm-hmm. there's, like, 80 of these live service games out now. They're split between them. So live service is a model that requires the majority of your time, as well as you telling your friends about it so that you can play together. That's why most live service games are multiplayer. Mm-hmm. And also, like, secondary investment in cosmetics and things. And it's just, it's too much. Eventually, people are going to stop and do something that doesn't try and fleece them for payment every time. But also, it makes it impossible for a new live service game to come out, because it's going to create that World of Warcraft effect of they're just going to leave this game alone, this new one, and go back to the one they spent all that time in, because all of them work on, like, levels and, you know, rankings and stuff.
Yeah, and once you
why would you
once you invest a certain amount of time by not playing that game, you admit to yourself, you know, you've lost all of that time. It's like a sunk cost.
It's diminishing returns.
Yeah. And,
and that's the thing, is like, people would much rather produce something that could potentially give them an infinite amount of money than something that might fail. Like a once-off thing that might fail. And it's so wild, because guess what? You know Bethesda Softworks, the company that makes Skyrim?
Yes.
Guess what they released?
What?
Recently. Hi-Fi Rush.
What?
Yeah, that's a Bethesda game.
They made that? They didn't just publish it?
I believe they made it, yeah.
What? That's crazy.
Oh, wait, no, they published
it. Okay, I was about to say, what?
It was developed by Tango Gameworks, and they published it. But still, they put their name on it.
They put their name on it, yeah. Hi-Fi Rush is a very unusual game.
It's a rhythm-based action game, for those of you who don't know. So it you fight by trying to match up your like attacks to the rhythm of the background noise, and it's like super high colored with this weird like cel shading style. It looks awesome. It's got a great soundtrack and it looks very fun. And everyone's named after, I think, T.
Yeah, it's got a
like the main character's name is
Chai. Looks like I'm gonna say this is probably a hot take, but I feel like so many games that come out today, they just all look the same. They all have the same like dark, very bland color palettes, you know.
Oh, or they're like ultra high colored, but in the same like color.
Yeah, palette. Yeah. Or they're either like ultra photorealistic, but they all just have the same color palette, you know, or they're just dark and moody and you can barely see what's going on without like cranking the gamma on the computer all the way up. It's not good, because games used to be very distinctive, right? You brought this up to me, Panzer Dragoon, right?
Yeah.
I looked up what that game was.
Weird.
I don't think you could make a game like Panzer Dragoon today. You know, I don't feel like a big studio would make a game like that.
A rail shooter where you ride a dragon on a desert planet? Not a chance.
Yeah, and you fight against weird looking like geometric shapes that could be all sorts of things, including, of course, you know, like demons and stuff. Like, Panzer Dragoon is the kind of game that is deliberately produced by someone who has something to say, and I feel like that becomes
God knows what it is.
Yeah, I don't know.
But they said it.
Yeah, I still, you know, I'm no more. I don't understand the plot, even though I read like the whole Wikipedia page.
Oh yeah, but Japanese games are like that. But that's what makes them captivating. Mm-hmm. The weirdness of finding the three umbilical cords in Bloodborne, so that you can fight Gurman, and then like you reject Gurman's offer and you fight him, and then you fight the like godlike entity that trapped you in the nightmare in the first place. Once you kill that, you turn into a squid.
Yeah, well, subverting traditional Japanese standards, instead of you fight God and then you become God, I guess.
Well, no, that's the reason you turn into a squid. You are reborn as a baby, like
old one,
elder
one. Yeah, yeah.
But here's the thing. Bloodborne is made by From Software, so they don't tell you most of the story. They expect you to go and find that out on your own. There's no hand-holding in this narrative.
There's no explanation of what anything is.
Like, imagine we don't have Vati Vidya. Imagine we don't have all those channels discussing Dark Souls and Soulsborne and whatever. Imagine getting to that point and becoming a squid and the game just ends.
Yeah, it will harken us back to the days in the 90s before like the internet was widespread. And the only people you could talk about any games with were the people at school who also had that game. So if you like went and got a weird video game, like you saw something on the shelf, was like, okay, I don't know what this is, let me just play it, and nobody else has ever heard of it, well, you're out of luck.
Dude, I managed to get Dark Souls like right before it blew up in this country. And I told my friend about it, Natasha. I was like, hey, I've got this game, it's really difficult, it's called Dark Souls, and she was like, cool, I'll go and try it. And then like a week later, everyone was fucking playing Dark Souls. And it was the wildest, like, it, not a week, like a month later. It was the wildest thing, because I had kind of given up on Dark Souls because it was too difficult. And then suddenly I'm hearing people like, oh, you just have to go and look up this guide. And then it's, you, like, you can do this. And I was like, I didn't know that this game existed outside of my bedroom.
Yeah, you're like, what small Japanese studio produced this weird...
I bet no one will remember them in 10 years.
Yeah.
Fucking Dark Souls got given the best game of all time award by the Golden Joysticks.
I don't understand how you could...
It's so...
say that, like, how it would the best game of all time, come on guys, like,
it's so subjective. You can't declare something the best of all time forever, no takesies backsies. That's not how life works. Dark Souls was a great and incredibly influential game, yes. It's not gonna be like, if you were to take all of gaming history and distill it into whatever it is, it would come up in several genres, and you can't say that Dark Souls is the best game of all time if it doesn't cross over into any other genres. It is purely a fantasy RPG.
I'm waiting for the rhythm rhythm Dark Souls game.
I mean, yeah, but like, that's the thing, like, what about shooters? Is Dark Souls just automatically better than every first-person shooter or third-person shooter that's ever existed, even though they're completely different genres?
Yeah, yeah.
What about sci-fi games?
What about strategy games? I know we...
What about strategy games?
Everyone is always fond of talking about how, adventure games are dead. You know a genre that's actually dead? The RTS genre. RTS fans are a lot more starved for video games than any like adventure games are. I did actually want to bring something up.
You foolish man. How dare you?
Yeah.
How dare you say that while we stand over the corpse of Panzer Dragoon? Like, rail shooters aren't dead as dust.
Rail shooters are dinosaur level extinct compared to RTSs, you know, which are just
RTSs are caveman extinct. A plague.
The question I wanted to ask, actually, is because I was also, when we were formulating ideas for this, I was thinking a lot about games like Hollow Knight and a couple of others. When does nostalgia just become a genre? Right?
You mean like a convention?
Yeah, yeah. So like
templates.
Yeah, so it's like a lot of games are harkening back. We call this genre the Metroidvania, right? However, it is easily possible for a person today to have never played any of the, especially the original Metroid game or the original Castlevania game or any of those games, and yet they can still play a Metroidvania. You know.
If I recall correctly, I think the original Castlevania game wasn't even necessarily a Metroidvania.
Yeah, I think it's Castlevania 2.
Symphony of the Night. What?
Yeah, it's one of the other games that is actually the reason why we call them Castlevanias.
Metroidvanias. I believe it's Symphony of the Night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's like the first game that inspired that term. It was Metroid 2. Or you know what? All the Metroids kind of do that thing where you have to go and unlock the powers. But Symphony of the Night was the first Castlevania game where you really, like, had to explore the map and you got branching paths so you could sort of decide your own way to go. And a lot of places were blocked off by, like, abilities or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's...
And that's... Yeah.
So I think that is kind of a problem. Like, when does nostalgia for a thing not... most people will never have played, like, Herzog's Y or... you know, Dune 2 or something, you know, they created the RTS genre. And yet, it's like, you know, what is the line, do you think?
Well, I think it's important to recognize the difference between, like, nostalgia and good game design.
Mm.
Having a world that opens up to you naturally by you gaining new abilities is good game design. As is having a world that gives you options in where to go. It's Metroidvania is just good game design because it makes everything feel more organic. Rather than like you don't have the key. Go to this place and fight this boss to get the key. It feels a lot less railroaded, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think once you have games that are coming out whose direct inspiration from the thing that they're, you know, nostalgic for, you can't actually really draw that line. I think that's when you're talking about like a convention solidifying, you know, like, for example, let's take, I keep thinking about strategy games, but like, let's take, strategy games like, maybe Dawn of War, because that hasn't been... But let's take a strategy game where, you know, it's very clear that the only thing that they borrow from the original, you know, earlier strategy games like StarCraft is a control scheme, you know? They don't have, like, thematic elements that are in common. They don't have, like, structural elements, you know? They're not trying to be an eSport or anything like that. I feel like at that point, then we can talk about, like, a convention, because I also do think, like, you know, nostalgia is a selling point for video games. If you go on Kickstarter, you'll see loads of games whose selling point this harkens back to the good old days, or this is like X genre, you know, brought back to life. It's like, okay, yeah, clearly it is a selling force for video games to be like other video games that people like. You know, even Panzer Dragoon had a Kickstarter remake. I don't think it did well.
Ukulele was just Banjo-Kazooie, mm-hmm. but modern.
Mighty Number 9.
Mighty Number 9 was, yeah, Broken Age, I guess, maybe. Mm. I don't know, but there's a definite, like, overfunded Kickstarter kind of wave that happens that is absolutely fueled by nostalgia. But here's my question to you. Do we measure nostalgia? My cat is eyeing my microphone stand with evil. Do we measure nostalgia on an individual basis? Because what about franchises?
Well, this is why I talked about, like, cultural and personal nostalgia, right? Like, a person's sense of nostalgia will be very varied, and it can even differ. It's like two people can play the same game and have different experience of it, you know? Like, Callum, you've played Halo, right? Are you nostalgic for Halo?
Kind of.
A little bit. I will actually tear up when I hear certain songs from like Halo 3 and stuff like that, right? Because I have such a...
The menu song. Yeah. Of like the Welsh male choir doing a Tibetan chant.
I think it's a Gregorian chant. That's what
a Gregorian chant. Sorry, but like that song does send like shocks down my spine.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm extremely nostalgic for those games, which is why I think I put up with a lot of stuff. You know, being a Halo fan is not easy right now, but it. Yeah. Two people can have different cultural experiences, like, but the industry...
It's like being a plague.
Yeah. But it's the industry itself that I think is very different, right? Because franchises nowadays have to go forever, right? Every game that comes out kind of doesn't think about itself as being a limited time thing, you know? Even games that are like live... Like the idea of... do you remember when... I think it was Anthem. You know, people hype. Oh, yeah, yeah. People were hyping up Anthem. So
that was BioWare.
Yeah, that was BioWare. That was, right. So the idea with Anthem was that Anthem was going to be a game that would run in perpetuity.
Yeah. Like all the other ones, like Overwatch and stuff.
Yeah, like all the other ones. But now.
Oh, by the way, Overwatch didn't run in perpetuity. They had to make a second one.
Yeah, they did, right? Because it's impossible to make a game run in perpetuity. It's just not possible. The core idea of the live service game is just not a thing that can be done. It's like you can't you know, walk up a wall. You can't make a game that runs lost forever. Nobody will keep playing it.
Yep. Look, I think ultimately, if we're talking about... cultural and individual nostalgia, like we said earlier, it can't be bad. It can't be immoral to view certain moments in your past or certain media properties as good, mm-hmm. and wonderful or whatever. It can't be, because that's not... It's subjective. It's purely based on your experiences. And there's transient nostalgia for things that you've never even touched. I have nostalgia for old school, like Final Fantasy style RPGs. The only kind of those that I've ever played was Pokemon, and that's like that kind of RPG, the light version.
That actually reminds me, right? One of the studies that I did was actually about Pokemon Go, right? And they talked about like how a big reason why the game was as popular as it was is because of a cultural collective nostalgia for Pokemon that transcended people who have actually played Pokemon games and kind of became like a cultural phenomenon for a while. However, one of the takeaways from that article and from some of the studies is that nostalgia is a very temporary feeling. You can only feel nostalgic for so long before you get tired of that feeling and you have to do something else. And so
nostalgia is like putting a sticker on your pencil case. You know, it's a cool sticker and you like it a lot and you see it and you're like, that's awesome. I love seeing that. Give it like a week and you will forget that your pencil case has a sticker on it.
Yeah.
But if that is like the good, the quote unquote good approach to nostalgia in gaming, the bad approach is filling the pencil case with stickers. Because then it's like, hey, look, we've brought all of these references for you to enjoy. This game is good, right? And then you just take all the stickers out and see there aren't any pencils, and now this is a box of stickers.
Yeah, it's, you know, you have, I think nostalgia is inevitable, but I think the way that you respond to it, I think, is what defines whether or not it's going to be good for you or bad for you. Because loads of people have nostalgia for stuff that is bad for them, or at least they manifest it in bad ways. Like people who talk about, like conservatives who talk about Star Wars discourse, right? They have constructed in their mind a version of Star Wars that does not exist, right?
Where the Empire is the good guys.
Well, yeah, where the Empire are the good guys, and where explicitly they're kind of like framing the struggle as like something, as not a struggle between an imperialist power and a rebel group fighting that imperialist power, you know. That is a bad way to do things. And obviously one of the problems is that if that behavior becomes normalized, then you kind of end up with a culture of media consumption and creation that is actually incapable of being critical. And that's when things will start to stagnate and become weird.
It's like the weird phenomenon people have with samurai.
Mm-hmm.
Because samurai are deeply viewed in culture as being like these honor-bound warriors that follow the Bushido code and everything. And that's not true. Samurai were more like medieval knights. They're basically landowners that committed horrible acts of violence for power, and they never followed this unified Bushido code, but like media has displayed them as such, and it makes them very popular with the alt-right in Japan.
People forget, you know, one of the more famous things that gets brought up about the samurai is, of course, you know, like the Satsuma Rebellion, right? You know, where the samurai tried to fight against the government, and there was a Tom Cruise movie, The Lost Samurai, right? I like that movie.
Ooh, that was a bad one.
I like
that was not a good one.
I like that movie personally, but the movie is incorrect, right? Because the samurai were fighting for their privileges. The thing that they were upset about is losing their ability to bully, coerce, and like just absolutely dominate society of people who weren't samurai. That was the thing that they were fighting for. They weren't fighting fundamentally for a spirit of Japan. They were fighting for their privileges. And so you see that, like, this is an example of building a history that wasn't there. The idea that the samurai were, like, benevolent is not really what most people would have experienced. Now, of course, there are good and bad samurai, but that's not the same.
Yeah, like, it's the same as, like, medieval knights. Like, samurai didn't invent honor. Honor was a big thing in pretty much every culture across the board, like dragons. But isn't that weird that most cultures on Earth know what a dragon is? But anyway, every culture has some form of honor, whether it's like pure honor or honor in the form of morality or something. But like medieval knights and samurai and whatever, there are always going to be examples of like good ones and bad ones. But also, giving that much power to someone isn't necessarily a great systemic way to maintain balance in your country.
Yeah, you don't generally want to provide a monopoly of force to a separate class of people.
Okay, wait. Before we get too deep into this weird new topic that we've invented, I do want to say, one, there's way too many movies about white people becoming samurai.
It did happen historically.
Yeah, but like still. Because it happened historically doesn't mean that every third samurai movie needs to be about it.
I think...
look at 47 Ronin.
I think the problem with that is that, like, in Japan, these movies are quite popular because Japanese people... The majority of samurai movies are made by Japanese people for Japanese people in Japan. They never actually get exported to here, outside of Japan. So invariably, when samurai movies do get made, it's because some auteur guy saw a lot of samurai movies and wanted to make something. And, you know, to introduce a Western audience to a non... you know, Western place, you've got to kind of like do stuff like that. It's like it's kind of like how when people, okay, so you know what's weird? That Parasite and Joker were two movies that were compared to one another when they came out, you know?
Okay, I didn't watch Parasite. I haven't watched it yet. I know that's wrong.
Yeah, well, it was a comparison that I saw being made very often. Like, oh, Parasite is like extrapolating a feeling of, alienation, capitalist alienation, that you also see in Joker. And it's like, what? That doesn't make any sense. But why? Well, I guess people always try to, you know, do... It's like when, in Japan, KFC is a Christmas thing. Why is it a Christmas thing? Well, probably because of marketing gimmicks, trying to project American culture in a country that isn't America. You know, Americans don't have KFC for Christmas.
Also, KFC does have Christmas colors.
Yeah, well, supposedly that is true as well. But, you know, it's one of those complicated things. I feel like we've gotten way off topic, which probably means it's time to end.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, nostalgia. So, to round this off, one of my favorite games in recent memory was Eastwood,
mm-hmm.
right? And one of the big reasons why it was my favorite is that it reminded me of old Zelda games mm-hmm. by the fact that it... You know, you had to incorporate... they incorporated puzzle solving into exploration.
Yeah, in a 2D isometric world. Yeah.
But it also gave me that same vibe of, like, old Ghibli movies, which were my favorite kind of movies mm-hmm. at the time.
Yeah, because it's painted. It's, like, a really high-quality pixel art.
Oh, yeah. No, it's beautiful. But not just that. I'm talking, like, the world design.
Oh, it's like...
The character designs. Just... Everything looks whimsical and charming, and charm can really carry you forward.
Yeah.
Especially if you're asking me to care about a world.
It's why we say graphics are temporary, art design is eternal.
Yep. But here's the thing about that. The reason Eastwood is one of my favorites is not because of those two factors on their own. Mm-hmm. It's because it has its own merits that it stands up on. The writing is pretty solid. It's pretty decently good, actually. The story is interesting. The world is interesting. I love the creativity going on, and it's fun mm-hmm. to play.
Yeah.
So it uses nostalgia to, like, elevate itself.
Yeah.
You can see... Sorry,
No.
Just one last thing to add. You can see that the nostalgia occurred naturally... Because those things that I'm nostalgic about, that this game reminds me about, were clearly influences.
Yeah, I think the takeaway is that if you're trying to actually use nostalgia, you actually have to understand what made the original thing good, right? Oftentimes, one of the problems with how the game industry applies nostalgia is they are trying to evoke nostalgia for a thing without understanding why that thing was originally good in the first place. Which is why the attempt at evoking nostalgia comes off as, like, shallow and very, like, money-driven, right? Whereas if you...
People can smell a cash grab.
Exactly. When you understand why something was good in the first place and bring that idea forward and iterate on it, then people can, you know, understand, you know, that you're doing something different. Whereas I think generally people can tell that something is just shallow for the sake of... making money, you know, it's trying to hit you with some dopamine for remembering stuff, you know.
Okay, so ultimately, we've come to the conclusion that nostalgia can't be bad in the same way that it can't be good. It's amorphous and transient, like the human soul.
Also, Callum is probably owed some credits.
I'm owed some.
You're owed some like credit on like a academic essay.
Oh yeah, I need my academic credits. Both of you people, or groups, or whatever, get in touch with me because I came up with these.
I feel like we should try and get Robin J. Sloan on the podcast. They're quite a popular.
Yeah, okay.
They've written like a bunch of articles on nostalgia and video games, and I feel like it might be fun to talk to someone like that.
Yeah, maybe we'll do an episode 2. If you'd like for us to do an episode 2, comment. Tell us. If you're not a big fan of commenting on videos, that will ruin our interaction. Our what's the company term?
The SEO.
Not engagement. SEO. Engagement, yeah. But if you don't want to comment on the video, but you still want to tell us your opinion, we have a Discord, and it's totally free. But thank you so much for watching. If you want to help support this video, there are 3 main ways you can do it. One, you can tell your friends, family, enemies, and especially acquaintances about this video. Get them to subscribe, and maybe check out our Patreon or buy us a coffee. 2, go and check out our socials. And 3... maybe the most importantly right now, check out the link in the description of the relief fund for Turkey. Emilio, do you want to tell them about that for a
moment? Yeah, Turkey and Syria recently had a very serious earthquake, and we are helping to do a little bit of fundraising for disaster relief. Basically, the charity literally goes and digs people out of the rubble. And tries to help them. So, yeah, it's a very good cause. Both Turkey and Syria do need help. And, yeah, if you donate to us and prove that you did it, the website will give you a little thing that you send to us. We will give you limited patron access.
It's a small reward, but it's to help people that really desperately...
Yeah, if you were going to already donate or do a good thing, why not get something for it, you know?
Yeah, and I guess that's the end of the video. Thank you for watching. And thank you, Emilio, for being here.
Tell us what games you're nostalgic for in the comments below, guys.
Oh, yeah.
That would be a fun thing to... Yeah, so...
And also, tell us what games that you're nostalgic for that you haven't played.
Yeah, that's true. Okay. Well, I'm Emilio, and this has been a great time.
We've really bitten the marks here. I don't know.
Yeah, this will be the episode that people are nostalgic for in like 20 years.
It's very hot today.
Yeah. All right.
The UV index is like 9.
Take
out of 12.
Take care, everybody. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
We would just like to give a very special thanks to our patrons who make this show possible. Thank you to Liam Anderson, Dorian, and Abwaitrung. Thanks, guys. You help us keep the lights on.